15. Next morning the cloud had cleared, and since the motel did not serve breakfast till 8, I went for a run to the gap. The heat was already building up. The hills were brown and furrowed in the early light. On my way out, I passed the fat man, floating upward in the pool. There was a scar on his stomach, as if the skeleton of a fish had been impressed on it.
"Good day to you, sir."
"Good day," I said. Across the street, some Aboriginal families had parked themselves on the municipal lawn and were freshening up under the lawn sprayer. They sat close enough to get sprayed, and not too close to kill their cigarettes. Some snot-nosed children were tumbling about and were glistening wet all over. I said hello to a bearded man who said,
"Good on you, mate."
I nodded to his woman who said,
"Go and suck eggs,"
and lowered her eyelids and laughed. I passed the confused young bodies pumping iron in the fun and fitness centre and then turned right along the riverbank and stopped to read a notice by some ghost gums. Registered sacred site for the Injalka caterpillar dreaming. Entry by vehicle prohibited. Penalty for damage, $2,000. There wasn't much to see, for a white man anyway. A broken barbed wire fence, some crumbly stones lying this way and that, and a lot of broken bottles in the bristly grass. I ran on and reached the gap, but was too hot to go on running, so I walked back. The fat man was still floating in the pool, and his fat wife was floating beside him. Her hair was in curlers and covered with a crinkly pink cap. I showered and packed my bag. I packed a pile of my old black notebooks. They were the notebooks for the Nomad book, which I had kept when I burned the manuscript. Some I hadn't looked at for at least 10 years. They contained a mishmash of nearly indecipherable jottings, thoughts, quotations, brief encounters, travel notes, notes for stories. I had brought them to Australia because I planned to hole up somewhere in the desert, away from libraries and other men's work, and take a fresh look at what they contained. Outside my room, I was stopped by a fair, mop-headed boy in patched and faded jeans. He was red in the face and seemed very agitated. He asked if I'd seen an Aboriginal kid.
"A kid with a rasta hairdo?"
"No," I said.
"Well, if you do see him, say Graham's waiting by the van."
"I will," I said, and went into breakfast. I had finished my second cup of disgusting coffee when the other Bruce came in and dumped his hard hat on my table. I said I was leaving town.
"Well, I won't see you, Brew," he said morosely.
"Maybe not, Brew," I said.
"Well, so long, Brew."
"So long." I shook his hand, and he went up to get his porridge. Arcady drove up at 9 in a brown Toyota Land Cruiser. On the roof rack were 4 spare wheels and a row of jerry cans for water. He wore a freshly laundered khaki shirt, from which the corporal's flashes had been removed. He smelled of soap.
"You're smart," I said.
"It won't last," he replied.
"Believe me, it will not last."
I chucked my bag onto the back seat. The rear of the cab was stacked with boxes of soft drinks and eskies. An esky, for Eskimo, is a polystyrene cool pack, without which a journey into the desert is unthinkable. We were halfway up Todd Street when Arcady braked, nipped into the desert bookstore, and came out with the Penguin Classics edition of Ovid's Metamorphoses.
"Present for you," he said. "Reading matter for the trip."
We drove to the edge of town, past the bedshed and territory wrecking, and stopped at a Lebanese butcher to pick up some meat. The butcher's son looked up as we came in and went on sharpening his blade. For the next 10 minutes we filled the eskies to bursting with sausages and slabs of steak.
"Tucker for my old men," said Arcady.
"Seems an awful lot."
"You just wait," he said. "They could eat a whole cow for supper."
We also bought some steak for an old bushy by the name of Hanlon, who lived alone beyond the Glen Armand pub. We drove on, past the sign to the old Alice telegraph station, and then we were out in the bare, scrubby country of the Burt Plain. The road was a straight band of tarmac, and on either side there were strips of red dirt with paddy melon growing over them. The melons were the size of cricket balls. They had been brought to Australia by the Afghans as fodder for their camels. Sometimes Arcady would swerve onto the melon to miss a road train coming south. The road trains had 3 trailers. They did not slow down, but came up, steadily out of the heat mirage, hogging the middle of the road. Every few miles we passed the gates of a cattle station, or a wind pump with cattle clustered round it. There were a lot of dead beasts, legs in the air, ballooned up with gas, and the crows on top of them. The rains were 2 months late.
"Marginal country," said Arcady.
Almost all the best pastoral leases had been bought up by foreigners, Vesties, Bunker Hunt and the like. No wonder Territorians felt cheated.
"The country's against them," he said. "The politicians are against them. The multinationals are against them. The Abbos are against them. Surely this country's only good for Abbos."
He described how once, while they were tracing a song line near Mount Wedge, the owner had driven up and, waving a shotgun, hollered, "Get off my land! Get them coons off my land!" So Arcady, who had already written the man 5 letters without receiving a reply, explained the provisions of the Land Rights Act, whereby traditional owners were allowed to visit their sites. This made the pastoralist hopping mad.
"There ain't no sacred sites on my land." "Oh, yes, there are," said one of the aboriginals present. "Oh, no, they're not. You're standing on one, mate."
The road curved to cross a creek bed, and on the far side Arcady pointed away to the east, to a switchback of pale brown hills. They stood up like cardboard scenery from the plain.
"You see the small hill there?" he asked.
"Yes." There was a smaller conical hill connected to the others by a low spur of rock.
"That," he said, "was where the railway people wanted to make a cutting. It would have saved at least 2 miles of track."
The hills lay on the northern edge of Aranda country, yet when Arcady sent word round the usual channels, no one wanted to claim them. He had been on the point of assuming there were no owners when an Aranda mob showed up in his office and said they were. He drove 5 of the men to the hills, where they moped about miserably, their eyes bulging with fright. Again and again he asked,
"What are the songs of this place, or what's the dreaming story here?"
They clamped their mouths and wouldn't say a word.
"I couldn't think what was up," he said, "so I told them about the cutting, and that really set them off. They all began blubbering, 'Black fella die, white fella die, all people die, end of Australia, end of world, finish.' Well, obviously," said Arcady, "that had to be something big. So I asked the elder, who's shaking from head to foot, 'What have you got down there?' And he cups his hand around my ear and whispers, 'Maggot power.'"
The song that lay along the lines of hills told of a dreamtime ancestor who failed to perform the correct ritual for controlling a bush fly breeding cycle. Swarms of maggots overrun the burnt plain, stripping it bare of vegetation, as it is today. The ancestor rounded up the maggots and crammed them back beneath the spur of rock, where, ever since, they'd been breeding and breeding underground. The old men said that if they cut into the hillside, there'd be a gigantic explosion. A cloud of flies would burst upwards and cover the whole earth and kill every man and animal with poison.
"The bomb," I suggested.
"The bomb," said Arcady grimly. "Some of my friends knew a lot about the bomb after it went off."
Before the British H-bomb testing at Maralinga, the army posted "Keep Out" signs in English for aboriginals to read. Not everyone saw them or could read English.
"They went through it," he said.
"The cloud?"
"The cloud."
"How many died?"
"No one knows," he said. "It was all hushed up. You could try asking Jim Hannon."